Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. This is Lingo, the show that's about relationship with language, how it goes beyond communication, and the impact it has on our lives, cultures, and traditions. Haka. It's a Maori challenge or posture dance. If you've ever watched a game of rugby where New Zealand's national team, the All Blacks, are playing, you'd see this before matches. That soundbite was from the 8th Rugby World Cup that was held last year, the final match between the All Blacks and Australia's Wallabies. The haka is done before each match. You'll notice that's done in the Maori language. The language has a long history in New Zealand. At the moment, it has over 125,000 speakers, but this is after major language revitalization efforts in the country. That's what we'll be exploring today. The Maori language's history, the revitalization efforts, and what it takes to regenerate a language. To learn more, we'll be speaking to...
Hi, my name is Tania Ka'ai. I'm the director of Te Ipu Karia, the National Maori Language Institute. Te tuata e mihi atu kia e Kelvin. E tono mai ki a hau ki te kōrero ki a koe koutou hoki te rahi te whānui ki Malaysia. Nō reira, tēnā koe, tēnā koutou.
Tania is really passionate about the Maori language and helping to revitalise it. I was curious why she was.
The language itself, there's Joshua Fishman, who was known as the father of language revitalisation. Provided us with this sort of adage that says it only takes one generation, at the most three, to lose a language. And it takes, many, many more to revive it within the family. And so many, the experience of New Zealanders, Maori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, is that through colonisation, the Maori language has been subsumed by the dominant English language. In as early as 1816, it was seen as the language of commerce and of education, of course. Quickly, you could see the community that Maori did not feature as part of or was not valued within the dominant culture's context. And so very quickly you have scenarios of families losing language. And that's certainly been the case with my family. So I have two grandparents or great-grandparents who were native speakers of the language born in the 1800s. And then progressively through that period, I am a second language speaker. And so began this, I became the heart of a movement, and also my love for the language and understanding language loss in my own family became involved at a very young age, prior to my even having a child, to working towards the restoration and recovery of language within my family. So I began to speak with my family members, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, on why the language, why they did not have intergenerational language transmission, why language not died in my family, I believe it's always dormant inside of you, but why there was not the why the language was no longer spoken in our home.
And why was that? Why wasn't Maori spoken in your home? Why didn't your great-grandparents speak it?
Well, my great-grandparents, the stories from my mother, as she remembers them, is that they spoke to each other. My great-grandparents spoke to each other in the language, but very quietly. But they chose not for their children because the rules of school were quite cruel in a way. Children were not, the language was banned from the school. So to the point where children whose first language was, were their native speakers of the language, were told that the language was not to be spoken within the school area. And so they couldn't play in the language, they couldn't speak to each other in the language. And in fact, corporal punishment, children were punished, physically punished, for speaking, you know, if they were heard speaking in the Māori language. And so they didn't want, as parents, we don't want our children to be, to any harm to come to our children. So, and also my great-grandfather was a teacher and a principal. So the rules that he was contracted and had to abide by was that English was vernacular, English was the medium of instruction, and therefore he, as a parent, not just a principal, as a parent, didn't want to impose corporal punishment upon any child, including his own. So they restricted the times that they would speak to each other, and so that it protected, really. It was a blanket of protection, an act of love to protect their children. And so you find that my grandmother probably understood. She understood more than what I would never hear her speak, but she understood, but she would never speak. And so then she married a non-speaker of the language, and so you get two non-speakers in a house, and then, of course, my mother. My mother, in Māori culture, often you grow up with grandparents, and she would always hang off the skirts, I guess, of her grandmother, and hear them speaking the language. So she has much, she again also has a greater understanding of the language, but doesn't speak it.
And the problem of Māori children not being allowed to speak their native language was pervasive throughout New Zealand at the time. It was because of education policies that made English the only language of instruction in schools, and Māori children were punished for speaking their languages. This was one of the factors as to why the Māori language saw a rapid decline of speakers at one time. After this, we learn more about the past to find out what caused it. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent maneuvers, BFM 89.9.
Hey there, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee, and this is Lingo, the show that's all about languages. We're talking about the Māori language today, one of New Zealand's official languages along with English and New Zealand Sign Language. It is, of course, a minority language. Today, we're speaking to Dr. Tania Ka'ai. She's the director of the National Māori Institute and also the International Centre for Language Revitalization in the Auckland University of Technology. Initially, Māori was the language of the land and there wasn't a threat to the language. Around the 1800s, the Māori population vastly outnumbered the European settlers. At that time, the settlers that came in learned the Māori language to use it in their encounters with locals. The English language that the settlers brought in with them wasn't yet seen as a threat to the local language. But that soon changed. After this agreement called the Treaty of Waitangi was signed, it was to formalise the relationship between the Māori and the British Crown. The treaty opened the floodgates and increased European migration so quickly that the Māori population was outnumbered. English soon became the dominant language. This led to a rapid decline in the usage of the Māori language, and there was a policy that also exacerbated this decline.
In 1840, when the treaty was signed, only 7 years after the treaty was signed, there was the British then, through a man called George Grey, implemented what was called the 1847 Assimilation, 1847 Ordinance. And what that really is that it was an Assimilation Act. And so it was a breach of the treaty that was around trying to ensure that we developed this country as partners. But what it meant was that English became dominant. It became the baseline for our education system. And therein it became that when you don't value a language and you don't allow it, you know, bilingual education to prevail and only English is chosen, that really was the mark of the beginning of the plight of the language and language loss. So that's where English became really dominant through legislation as well. Third 1930s, there was a man who was the Director General of Education, a guy called T.B. Mr. Strong, and he said that the natural abandonment of the native tongue is no loss to the Māori. And so, you know, if you have leadership and government making statements, official statements like this, then and only valuing English, where all the books were written and all the textbooks were written in English, and then you have educational legislation tracking all the way through from 1847 right the way through even to 1960 with the Hun report, and which basically said that, you know, Māori has the right to their language, to be, you know, language and culture, but still the education system only really valued the culture, would only let us sing our songs but not learn the language.
It was a top-down approach through government and legislation that really eroded the health of the Māori language. And that had implications into the home as well. Earlier we heard about Tanya's family and how her grandparents didn't speak the language at home.
There are families that I have spoken with and, you know, throughout my life, parents of the children that I've taught and who have been native speakers of the language, but refuse to teach their children. And that's because they see that they've been told that the language has no value. And so they don't want their children to be chastised, criticised for having the language. And they've been almost indoctrinated and with fear as well, not to be part of, not to value the language, that it has no currency, it's of no use at all, and that they're better off speaking English and pursuing Western knowledge than to even consider that our language and culture has any kind of currency and status, that it's a, you know, and there has been that attitude amongst our own community. And when that's present and in a part of that, it's a dangerous situation to we find then kids often wait for their parents to die, or they've grown up and have become adults, and then they start their journey because they know they're Māori, they start their journey as adults to learn the language. because they know there's something missing. It's to do with their, you know, that's that social impact you're talking about, that it has huge social impact when you are lacking an identity, when you're searching for a sense of belonging and place in the world. That has huge consequences for our community and for people who sometimes find themselves living, for example, in Australia. We have a huge population in Australia. And so we have people who come back in search of their own sense of family, family identity, community, and they find that through the language. It's like a pilgrimage. It's a journey back in one of recovery to become whole. There's been something missing in their lives. That's not an uncommon story, you know, an unusual story. It's these families across New Zealand that can talk about, you know, yes, that's happened to us as well.
Activists fought hard against this, against the 1847 ordinance. There were uprisings against it from the Maori community around the 1970s, especially from university students. The students
hit the streets and took a petition to Parliament and presented it on the footsteps of our New Zealand Parliament, our government, and said this is a petition that says we have to have Māori language taught in our schools. And they wanted it from preschool. That was the focus. But the government then only introduced it as a subject at high school, at secondary school. And so they won the fight, but they lost the battle in terms of where the language was taught. And they could see that in spite of all the research, international research that was happening in Wales and in Quebec and in places like Ireland, where, you know, they were looking at fighting for the return of the rights of Indigenous languages to be taught with Indigenous communities, with their communities. In spite of all that research and that history, we still only ever introduced the language in high school in 1970-71. So it was many, many years from 1816 right through to the petition before Māori was introduced as a subject to be learned at high school. And then, of course, in 1981, when we had another uprising of community, the mobilisation of Māori parents saying enough is enough, as well as elders. And we had we stopped sending our children to school and started kōhanga reo in our church halls, in our homes, in our lounges, in our homes, in all different places with very little money, and it was not at all. It was seen as being illegal.
Māori leaders and communities started the kōhanga reo as a means to recover the language. Kōhanga reo literally means language nests. They're kind of like preschools, kindergartens, or daycare centres. Children in these nests are immersed in the language. The kids would play, talk, pray, and learn together in the Māori language.
And then the fight that was 2 years, 3 years before kōhanga was actually recognised. And then we have the Kura Kaupapa schools as well that again started and weren't recognised for 2-3 years. These schools were operating before the New Zealand Government and Education Department recognised them, and then they were and became an act, part of an act, and then they were able to receive state funding. So all the way along, you've seen that it's really through education that has been an instrument to really undermine the status of the language. And it is Māori responses to that over time that have really led to this new path of ensuring that we have Māori medium education.
It was a victory because now there are more Māori medium schools all the way from preschool to high school. And if you think about it, it's something we don't really see anywhere else where minority language is deemed valuable enough to have a school. But is education enough to save a language? Aside from schools, they even have Māori medium television and radio stations. You might recognise this.
Morita koutou!
Oi, a kate!
Kaoreo i tarongo!
Oi!
Non io fare panapurue!
After this, we find out more about the other initiatives to revitalize the Maori language. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee and this is Lingo. Today we're exploring the Maori language. Maori is a minority language with most speakers based in New Zealand. We continue our conversation with Dr. Tania Ka'ai. She's the director of the National Maori Institute and also the International Centre for Language Revitalization in the Auckland University of Technology. So they have Maori medium schools, but is education the only way to revitalize a language? Is it enough?
No, it's not. It's not enough until the language is alive and well in Maori homes. I think that the language is always going to be at risk. And that's a huge fear that is shared by many of us in, that are part of this movement. Schooling and education is not enough, but it was a start. It was a way of mobilising Māori communities across the country. And it was marvellous because no more were we saying and just accepting that we have to send our children to mainstream education. And so our communities were saying no, but they were also then involved in saying, okay, this is a start. And it enabled many of us to take on another role to say what else needs to happen. And so, there were people who weren't involved in education who were committed to saying, let's have a television channel. Let's have a television station, a Māori broadcasting service. And so began it, those people who were involved and passionate about broadcasting, they became activists in language activists like us who are involved in education, those of us involved in. So it helped to mobilize other parts of our community, which led to the establishment of radio stations. We call tribal radio stations all around the country so that they would go to air broadcasting in the medium of the Māori language. So that was very, very effective, yeah? So that's another angle that came in that was alongside Māori education. And then, of course, we fast forward to today, we have the Māori television service, we have a real channel on TV, and we have the proliferation of production houses that create Māori language programs from children's, little children's programs or preschool programs in the language to people who write drama series. So we have drama series as well to Māori language. We've been involved in that as an institute.
Tania's institute also helped with creating Māori language learning programs for these television stations. It was based on a book by one of their professors, John Moorfield. It was called
Te Kākano, Te Whanake, which are a series of texts and resources, both print and digital. And so that was the basis from which this television series of language learning series was developed, and it's still going. So, you know, there are a whole raft of programs that have been developed and then garnered the interest of communities to say, okay, we want to write scripts and feature films. Now we have movies and playwrights and people who are translating Romeo and Juliet, which was, this is an important time of year for us, Matariki, and this time is our new year, Māori New Year. And so this time last year, one of our colleagues, Te Haumihiata Mason, she had translated Romeo and Juliet into Māori, and they performed that, and it was beautifully done. So, you know, you're now getting, you're seeing also the mobilisation of musicians. So people who have the language, who are kohanga reo graduates, who are immersion, who come through immersion and Māori medium education, are now coming out and composing their music in Māori and making hit songs because there's such a great following. And they're taking that to the world. So they're getting airtime. So music is another form of how language is permeating through all aspects of our society. And of course our children, it's a great resource for our children because we're able to then always have music on the radio or music on the television or music in the car when we're picking them up from school, that's Māori, and they sing along to that music.
It's a whole ecosystem that's required to revitalise a language. One of the tips to learn a new language is to immerse yourself in the culture and the language. It's exactly the same thing here. If you only use the language in school and it stops there, that isn't enough. It's also getting involved beyond schools and watching television.
There's Māori artists as well who... and I'm not sure if you know that we have a form of tattoo called moko, which is a form, a real form of vanity, I guess, but it was also around identity. So you're getting, we now have young people who are learning the art form to ensure not just its preservation, but its application within community. And the language that goes with that and the rituals and customs that go with the art of moko. And again, you know, that's an important aspect of language that goes with that and other art forms like weaving and all of those fine arts that are part and parcel of our culture. Yeah, I'm trying to give you sort of the wraparound view that it's not just education, that we try to find our kids avenues of ways, and Waka'ama is another one where, you know, you would be familiar with dragon boat racing. Well, we have Waka'ama, which is also an important form of racing for us in canoe. And so that's just attracted the revitalization of Waka'ama is a family event. So families go with their children and, It's a marvelous, marvelous opportunity for our children to, one, speak the language to each other while also participating in this fabulous sport, and for families to meet and have barbecues together and also speak in language. So, you know, there's all of these wonderful community events that help us to give us the opportunity to keep our language alive, and we encourage the spoken language and in a raft of areas, at, you know, parent-teacher meetings in schools and in schools to playing sport and netball and rugby and all of our different sports that we have to ensure that there is that we're not just relying on the schools to save the language. We have to do so much more.
So it seems like New Zealand has some idea on how to revive a language. What can other countries learn from them?
What can we learn from New Zealand? I think that's a question I'd like to respond to is in a humble way. You can't mirror societies are different, and so you can't mirror kind of activities or events. But you can learn from the models. You could take a model, for example, like Hawaii. In Hawaii, they've taken the kohanga reo and they've created the punana reo, which is a similar early childhood context, but they've Hawaiianized it. They've customized it around their own cultural, their own language and their cultural nuances. And so you can take the model, like the shell, and then you develop it according to your own cultural nuances and the language that you're trying to revive. The one thing that I'll probably say is the most important thing is you have to be passionate and you have to drive this. You can't just sit and think that, and you have to have a multi-prong approach, broadcasting, education, musicians, just do it. All of us, if we all did these things and according to our talents, then what we do from there is that you have a range of activities all happening at the same time. And I think that's something that I would probably leave with any or as something that you can learn from us, the multi-pronged approach, the passion and the drive.
The revitalization of the Maori language is still a work in progress. A lot more still needs to be done. And with the amount of work that's ahead, I wonder how Tanya feels about the language's future.
I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because I believe that our children, our graduates from Kohangareo and Kura Kaupapa Māori immersion schooling are now having their own children. And they are passionate about the language and they are speaking to their children in language and they are speaking to their children in their homes and they are sending their children to immersion Māori medium schools and they are creating opportunities in language in across a range of areas for their children where they are swimming and playing sport in language. So I'm hugely optimistic, but my hope and my dreams are with this new generation of 30 and 40 year olds who are driving this change, and they're not waiting for government top down change. They're driving it at the grassroots level.
My thanks to Dr. Tanya Ka'ai. She's the director of the National Maori Institute and also the International Centre for Language Revitalization in the Auckland University of Technology, New Zealand. To find other episodes from this series, go to bfm.my/lingo. I'm Kelvin Yee, and this has been Lingo on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right.
What is this? This looks good.
Wow,
that's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you, with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.